dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Upon entering the new millennium, our nation marked the end of the most punishing decade in our people's history. More people began a prisoner jail term in the United States during the 90s than any other decade on record. There are now over 2 million incarcerated in the country, so often called the land of the free. It's no secret that punitive drug laws fuel this terrible rush to imprisonment. By studying drug law convictions over the past 20 years, researchers have produced alarming figures. The number of people sent to jail or prison for drug law violations increased by more than 1,000%. 1 in 4 prisoners in the United States is serving time for a drug law violation. In the federal system, these people make up about 60% of the prison population. A growing number of voices from across the political spectrum are daring to say that the drug war does not reduce drug use. That choosing to wage a war on drugs stimulates a violent underground economy, an economy which would collapse if drug prohibition ended, and that this decades-long war on drugs is not making our country safer, simply less free. In the first hour of our program, a documentary by Kurt Schrell focusing on highlights from a drug policy conference held earlier this month at Rice University in Houston, Texas. Then in our second hour, a community forum, New York State Prisons Inside and Out, which was held earlier this month in Ithaca as part of a New York interfaith prison pilgrimage.
Robin the rich. So for best, they take it by stealing and lying and gambling, and I take it my way, my shiny black.
Mr. Hutchinson.
I consider debating drug policy or discussing drug policy a significant challenge, but also an opportunity to articulate the facts that are important in developing policy that's going to shape our future and impact so greatly the next generation.
The only difference from 1920 and now is they can't take us out and hang us on a tree. They can just send us to prison for life. It's the same thing. We ain't gonna never be free again. We all gonna die.
In the last 2 decades, the war on drugs has become a principal excuse for locking up tons and tons of black and brown people. They call that racial profiling, and they do that everywhere, everywhere. So why is it you got so many black folks getting locked up? Because we're the only ones they're looking for.
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment. My name is Howard Wooldridge. I'm a retired police officer from Bath Township, Michigan. And simply put, as another voice in law enforcement, as a colleague of mine once said, in terms of enforcement, in terms of stopping vehicles, it's 2 blacks, 2 browns, 2 yellows, or I don't stop the car. Why bother? Of course, to use racial slurs. But that, in a nutshell, tells you where law enforcement is coming from and why there is this incredible disparity between who's arrested and who is not.
In the spring of 1998, Sheriff Larry Stort decided to investigate the drug scene in Tulia, a small town in the Texas Panhandle. Using funds from a regional drug task force, the sheriff hired an undercover agent named Tom Coleman to conduct a covert sting operation.
The Honorable Asa Hutchinson.
And it is important because it impacts in such an incredible way, our family, our neighbors, and our communities. We are all touched in a very personal way by the impact of drugs.
In 18 months, Coleman had allegedly made more than 100 controlled buys of powdered cocaine. As the images of suspects appeared on the evening news, it was clear that those caught in the sting had something in common. 39 of the 46 arrested came from Tulia's tiny black community, which numbers less than 350. More than 10% of the town's black population had been taken down on the word of one man.
7 in the morning. Honest to goodness, by 12:01...
In a very personal way.
They came with eviction notices. I mean, there was 13 women...
Our neighbors.
...in the cell together.
Our family.
And we all received these eviction notices at the same time. If that's not conspiracy for something, then what is?
We are all touched.
We hadn't even been completely booked in. We hadn't even got our bond, you know, sentencing or anything before we got eviction notices.
Our neighbors.
And, you know, we were thinking, the ladies that were locked up, you know, they had children. What were they going to do? How were they going to get their stuff moved out of the house and everything?
Our family.
I mean, it was just one hard day that day. I mean, everything was taken away in one swoop.
And our communities.
Not one of the raids turned up drugs, weapons, or significant amounts of cash.
If there were that many drug dealers here, I just wondered why I couldn't ever borrow any money from anybody. I mean, no one had any money. Nobody had bank accounts. Nobody owned a home. Nobody owned a car. Cars were repossessed. And I mean, nobody owned anything, you know? And for them to say that was many drug dealers here, and for Tom Coleman to spend as much money as he had here, you know, you'd think they'd have found some of that money, you know? Or found some of the merchandise that was bought with that money. There's nothing, you know, there's nothing.
Gary Gardner, a farmer who lives in nearby Vigo Park, became an advocate for the defendants.
I initially got into it because of a lot of the statements that I thought were prejudicial. Plus, the way that they drug these people in front of the cameras. I guarantee you, if you drug my wife in front of the camera at daylight without letting her comb her hair, she's going to come across not a pretty person, although she's one of the prettiest women I know. And they had facilities up there to protect the dignity of these people. They have a garage up there at the jail they could have drove these cars in and unloaded these prisoners and booked them without doing that embarrassing number. So they had to have done that deliberately. And the only reason I could think of to do it was to influence the people in town that these people were guilty. I don't consider anyone I'm convicted yet. I don't care if they have had 11, 10, 15 trials, because they haven't had a fair trial in front of an impartial group of their peers. And until they do, in my books, they're not convicted. They're just being held illegally.
More than half of the defendants pled not guilty and went to trial. Many were sent to prison, their sentences ranging from 20 to more than 300 years.
But I told them, I said, if you didn't do it, you know, we were just saying, oh, you're going to be okay. You'll retrial, you'll get out of this.
I said, well, I said, you didn't do it, did you? He told me, no. I said, well, if you didn't do the crime, then you stand to be right. And that's why Freddie didn't take a plea bargain. That's why he went to trial.
Joe Moore, the first defendant tried, was described by District Attorney Terry McEachern as one of Tulia's major drug dealers. At 67 years old, Joe Moore, a hog farmer, was the oldest defendant. He was sentenced to 99 years for 2 counts of cocaine delivery.
He was made out to be the horriblest, baddest person, you know, in the world. The kingpin, the top man or whatever.
He never owned any expensive vehicles, any expensive toys, or any expensive house. If he ever made any money dealing dope, he still got it, because he damn sure didn't spend it.
In Joe Moore's case, it was used as an example to the rest of the blacks. You plead or you go down for life.
That's mainly why I took the plea bargain. I was scared. I wanted to see my family. I had seen how much time they gave other people. I figured they'd do the same to me, which they would. I ain't no different from them. We all black.
It really haven't changed, because they was doing this when I was a little girl. I remember when we had to go through the back door to get hamburgers or whatever, you know. I remember all that stuff. So I guess it's trying to get back like that. I don't know what
it
is.
Why do we have federal money for undercover? We have an undercover in here all the time. Trying to, basically, the way I see it, is seduce young people.
Mm-hmm.
That's their job, is seduction. Anyway, I'm afraid for my children, and I'm afraid for everyone's children because of this mindset of catching people, of catching them and punishing them. It's frightening, and it's wrong.
Asa Hutchinson.
And it is important because it impacts in such an incredible way our family, our neighbors, and our communities. We are all touched in a very personal way.
The main reason I played out is because if I wouldn't have, I knew I was probably going to do get at least 25 max. I mean, nothing less. And the second reason I played out is because my friend Michelle Williams, she had gone like a week prior to that and got sentenced, you know, and her kids were here. And I had someone to take care of my kids if I were to go, but who was going to take care of hers?
Our nation's future.
I just didn't want to leave them, you know, hanging out there to dry.
Our family.
So that's one of the reasons I took the plea. It's for the kids.
Our neighbors.
And the kids, they just cry and cry. You know, they wake up at night, they want their mama, and they cry and cry and cry.
We are all touched in a very personal way.
And sometimes I'm here, but I'm crying.
Our family.
So, you know, it's pretty rough.
Our neighbors.
And it's not only me. I think a lot of the families,
family.
They just, when they by themselves, they probably just cry and they just wonder, you know,
our neighbors,
why this happened like
and
that.
Our communities.
It's no future for them here, the young black people. You're wonderful as long as you're winning our football games, our basketball game.
The Honorable Asa Hutchinson.
In Arkansas, we love football, specifically Razorback football. And I remember a game that is of epic proportions in Arkansas. And if memory serves me well, we ultimately punted on third down in a key situation.
We come together on sports.
And so what does this have to do with drug policy?
Now, that's about the only thing that I've seen that can bring two of you together.
And as a result, the Razorbacks lost that game 7-0.
Like most of the boys that they got were athletes, and now
in
high school.
Well, I believe that there are some folks that would like to punt on third down.
Yeah. And yeah. They junior high, and now they're arresting them.
Yeah.
Not giving us a chance to move to fourth down.
But as long as they was on the football team winning their games, they would
and actually make a first down.
Run and they race, run, boy, run.
And have success in this effort.
They wouldn't have cared. But now when they graduated, oh, we ain't going to worry about them no more. We can't help them no
that,
more.
That punting on third down should reflect the true perspective.
Talking about a young individual who graduates that happens to be black. If that individual is a star athlete.
The true perspective on our efforts and the progress that we've made.
For some reason, that individual ends up in prison here. They graduate from high school, they get their PhD in the prison. Prison house diploma.
And the progress that we've made.
Run, boy, run!
And throw away the kids.
It is not third down. Judge James Gray is a veteran judge of the Superior Court in Orange County, California. In fact, it isn't even fourth down. He's a former federal prosecutor in Los Angeles and a criminal defense attorney with the Navy JAG Corps. This ball has changed possession to the degree that this game is over. He's the co-author of an important book, Why Our Drug Laws Have Failed and What We Can Do About It, which is a thoughtful book that includes back cover praise from Walter Cronkite, Milton Friedman, George Shultz.
It really is a question that the situation under our present policy of drug prohibition is hopeless. It is hopeless. It will never get better.
It's a pleasure to have him with us here today to talk about his perspective as a judge.
Literally, victory today is being defined as slowing down the pace of defeat. That is my position. So let's understand, though, from the outset, two fundamental things. One is, critically important, that people understand it is not the fault of law enforcement that we're in this position. We are not pointing the finger at law enforcement saying you failed us. because it is the system itself. It is the same thing to point the finger at law enforcement today saying you failed to cure this war on drugs problem or drug prohibition would be the same thing at blaming Elliot Ness for the failure of alcohol prohibition. It's not their fault. It is the system that has done it. Secondly, equally importantly, we must understand that everyone in this room, and really all people in the nation, except for the drug lords, are on the same side of this issue. We all want to reduce drug use and abuse and all of the crime and misery that goes with it. The question where we may differ is how best to accomplish that goal, but that is the common ground. That is what we are all attempting to do. So let's stop shouting at each other, let's stop calling each other names, and get on with that business. So I finally decided, who better to be able to communicate a message of this kind than someone like me? I'm a pretty tough dude, actually. I'm a pretty conservative person, pretty clean cut. Maybe my hair is a little longer now than it should be, but I've never used any of this stuff before, never going to. You can make cocaine available on every street corner, bless it by the Pope, and I'm damned if I'm going to jam cocaine up my nose. I'm not going to do it, and I don't think you are either. So let's recognize then that we are all on the same side of this issue, and I felt that if I would speak publicly about this issue, that people would have to listen to the message, and by and large, that is what's happened. But I got to tell you, to get a little personal, it was a scary thought. I didn't know what the response would be. But I can also tell you, just like everyone in this room, I love my country. I hate these drugs so much. I hate so much what the presence of these drugs in our communities can and does do to people, and I see it all the time in my courtroom, that I want to do what I can to reduce that misery, that harm, that crime, that disease, that danger. And so I told myself, this is a time in which I can do something significant for my country. So I told myself, all right, Jim, don't be afraid. It's okay. It's the right thing to do. So I held that press conference, and I've been speaking as publicly as I can ever since. What do you talk about? Dr. Martin was very charitable in his introduction. I can tell you I remember one introduction that was not quite as charitable, a lot shorter. In fact, I can remember it verbatim. It was on the order of, I know you all want to hear the latest dope from the courthouse, so here's Judge Gray. But there are lots of things to talk about. What we fundamentally need to do is to open up the discussion. We need to communicate to all of our people, our taxpayers, and our voters one simple thing. In fact, as soon as we communicate that message, we will change away from this failed system. And that message is, it's okay to talk about drug policy. Just because we discuss drug policy does not mean that we condone drug use or abuse. If we get that one point across, the whole shooting match is over, because there are so many harms that we are unnecessarily inflicting upon ourselves because of drug prohibition. Every major neutral survey in our country, as well as in Canada and Great Britain in the last 100 years, has recommended that we go away from the criminal justice approach because of all of the harms that we're inflicting upon ourselves. We need just that open, honest, thorough discussion. So all we need to do then is to tell our people, don't be afraid. It's okay. It's the right thing to do. And I've been a judge now for 18 years. What are the harms that I have seen us inflict unnecessarily upon our people? The United States of America leads the world in the incarceration of our people. We have more people incarcerated in the United States of America, both by sheer numbers as well as per capita, as any other country in the world. Here, we're number one does not make me proud. We have more people incarcerated per capita than South Africa during the height of apartheid, more than the Soviet Union when it was in vogue. There's got to be something wrong here. What else? We have in California, where I'm from, talk about three strikes and you're out. This is a statistic that curdles my blood. We have four times more people incarcerated right this minute serving a 25 years to life sentence for a marijuana violation than for robbery, rape, and murder combined. We have thousands, in fact, we have tens of thousands of people in prison in California right this minute because they did nothing but smoke marijuana. That is not a statistic that you will hear from him, but it's true. You know how? Because people are sent to prison for whatever reason, and then at a certain time they're put on parole. Do you know as well as I do what one of the terms of parole is? That you not use any form of illicit substance. And if they smoke marijuana, they're hooked and they're sent back to prison. Either they don't go and get their urine test. If they fail to show for the urine test, that's a violation and they're sent back to prison. Or if they do, marijuana stays in your system for upwards of 30 days. So if they've smoked marijuana within the last month, they're sent back to prison, and we have thousands of those people in prison for just that reason. In fact, you talk about supply and demand, incentives, and you fail to realize what we're doing by this present system. Because the message is to our felons on parole, as well as everyone else in society that's concerned about drug testing and losing their jobs, and certainly to our children, the message fundamentally is, if you're worried about being caught, take cocaine, don't take marijuana. Why? Because cocaine will stay in your system for about 72 hours. The marijuana will stay in your system to be detectable by your analysis for about 28 to 30 days. That is not the message we want to send. But that message is being received. There are cardinal rules of prohibition. You would think that we would have remembered and learned those rules during alcohol prohibitionary times, because we're still living in prohibition today. It's drug prohibition with the same results. But just analyze this. We understand that college students are beer drinkers, basically. Right? I think that you may remember that. What happens when they go to a football game? It's prohibited to bring in alcohol into the football stadium, right? What happens? They're converted to whiskey drinkers, right? Easier to conceal. Stronger stuff. Same rule during alcohol prohibition. Do you know what happened? You, as a bootlegger, would run the same risk for a barrel of beer as a barrel of whiskey. So which would you push? Easy. Whiskey. And we turned a nation from beer drinkers more into whiskey drinkers. We're doing the same thing today with regard to pushing a lot of people who, rightly or wrongly, are using marijuana as their drug of choice, and we're pushing them up the scale. That is not what we want to do. So there's so many things to talk about. Are the drugs available today? I talked to you about when I was a prosecutor as opposed to today. 80% strength, half the price and the availability. We can't keep drugs out of prison, folks. How do we expect to keep drugs off the streets if we can't even keep them out of our prisons? So it's not a question of condoning this. It's a question of realizing that ever since mankind has walked the face of the earth, we have had some form of mind-altering, sometimes addicting drug present in our communities. We always have, and we always will. So if that's the case, and it is, let's try to take every step we reasonably can to reduce the harm that can and will be caused from them. We cannot stop people from selling small amounts of drugs for large amounts of money. That is a cardinal rule of human behavior. The other one is the law of supply and demand. If the demand is here, Mr. Hutchinson, the demand will be met. And here we are talking about reinforcing all of those programs that have been proved not to work. And we're talking about strengthening them. Talk about poor Colombia. Come on. What is really happening? What is really the facts here? You could bulldoze Colombia, Mr. Hutchinson. You could obliterate, take it off the face of the world. Take Bolivia, take Peru along with it. And you know what? It won't make the slightest bit of difference with regard to our drug problem here. Why? Because if the demand is here, the demand will be met. And if it isn't met in Peru and Colombia and Ecuador, it will be met in Nigeria or Burma or Afghanistan or California. Do you know, folks, what the largest cash crop is in the state of California today? Marijuana. Number two is corn. Why? Because if the demand is here, the demand will be met. And then we in the United States of America are so arrogant, and that's the word for it, arrogant in deciding whether or not we will certify other countries as working hard enough to help us with our drug problems. That is a brash, arrogant thing to do, and we're hated for it. Whether we're going to certify Mexico, whether we're going to certify the government of Colombia. Let's talk facts here. Should we certify the government of California because marijuana is the largest cash crop in its state? We should decertify that government to be consistent, but don't look for consistency in this area. And then, fundamentally, I know that people in our country are prepared to swallow some problems. Swallow the problems in Colombia. Swallow the fact even that we have lost more of our civil liberties because of the war on drugs than anything in the history of our country. That's a hard swallow, folks. In fact, I have a chapter in my book that I call The Erosion of Civil Liberties. If I were to write that chapter again, the subtitle would be, Where's Paul Revere? Who is spreading the alarm? It's so easy to give away our rights and so almost impossible to get them back. But we do all of this, and I think some of us would do it knowingly, if it would protect our children. The problem is the reverse. The problem is our policy of drug prohibition is affirmatively putting our children in harm's way, at least for four reasons. Number one, it is easier for our children to get illegal drugs than it is a six-pack of beer. Now, all right, I was under 21 for a while. Maybe some of you people were too, and you knew that you can get alcohol, right? Okay, all right, we know that. But it takes a little ingenuity, takes a little effort. The illegal drugs find our children. You might say, oh, a drug lord doesn't care if my 16-year-old daughter uses cocaine. But that's not true. He does care. He wants her to because he makes money at it. Number two, we all want our kids, particularly during the summertime when they're away from school, to what? Stay home and play Nintendo and sleep late? Not a chance. We want them to get a job, right? So we chase them off to entry-level positions, which is a great thing. Learn the value of the dollar. Do you know what happens during the summertime? Frequently, they will be off in some form of party or other, and they'll meet somebody that's their contemporary who sells drugs. So the discussion comes up. Hey, you're working, aren't you? Yeah. Where are you working? Oh, I'm working bagging groceries or at a car wash or whatever I'm doing. Oh, yeah? How much money did you make last week? Well, I made $150. $150? Boy, are you a sucker. You know, I can earn four times that much money in an afternoon selling drugs. And he's right. And everybody knows that he's right. And we are undercutting the work ethic of our children in a disastrous way. We might as well take out billboards telling our kids, are you interested in making big money? There's no way you can ever do it except by selling drugs. And this is a harmful thing caused by drug prohibition. Number three, what happens? I see this all the time in our court system. We talk about getting tough, right? Increasing the penalties. It's what we always do. You know what happens when we increase the penalties for adults, mandatory minimums and the rest for drug transactions? They go out and recruit children because everyone and their half-sister, including the children, juveniles, know that we treat our juveniles less strongly, less severely in the juvenile court system than we do adults in the adult court system. And I agree with that. I think it's a good idea. But the kids know it too. So ask yourself this question. How much risk-taking can you buy for $100 in cash to a 16-year-old boy in the inner city or almost anywhere else? And the answer is, quite a bit. So adults go out and recruit children to be involved in drug markets. They'll pay them, say, $100 in cash, which is chump change for a drug dealer, a lot of money for a kid. And they find, with a little bit of threats of violence, which they do, and this chump change, they have somebody that's pretty reliable. So they'll use them as gophers. They'll use them as lookouts. They'll use them even as drug couriers. And then you know what happens? As night follows day, as soon as the reliability of these youngsters is established, the adults trust them to go out and sell small amounts of drugs for larger amounts of money, both the kids and themselves. Happens all the time. Ask yourself this final clinching question. Who does a 16-year-old boy or girl in the inner city sell drugs to? Us? No. He and she will sell drugs to their 15, 16, 17-year-old peers. And that recruits more young people into a lifestyle of drug usage and drug selling because of the money, because of our laws of drug prohibition. I see this. The evidence is in, folks. And we are really suffering as a result of that. And to carry that story out a little farther, say a year or two from now, this first fellow, if he's still alive, he certainly will start using drugs. It's available, it's free swinging and the rest. If he's still alive, his life is probably a wreck. But don't worry, because now his recruits are carrying on his business, and it continues on in this fashion. Number four, how many of you remember this very gifted basketball player, Len Bias? Anybody? Yeah. University of Maryland. wonderful, wonderful basketball player. And as the story goes, he was celebrating at night because he had been drafted number one by the Boston Celtics. Wouldn't you? You know, his financial future is secure. So he took cocaine for the first time in his life, had an allergic reaction, and died. You know what we did as a result of that? Oh, made all the papers, you know, just all of this, this recrimination. How can we allow this to happen? What did Washington do? Same thing as they always do. They increased the drug mandatory minimum sentences. You know what the real story is of Len Bias? Len Bias was on his third convulsion before his, it's hard to call them friends, people around him sought medical attention for him, and by the time they did, it was too late and he died. Why would they wait? They could see he was in distress. Why would they wait? Easy. Because they were concerned about his legal health and they were concerned about their own legal health. So they delayed that critical time period until he died. I represent to you that if we had a different system, that he would still be living, likely living today. We're close to Plano, Texas here, as I understand it. It's a fairly affluent suburb of Dallas. The same problem happened in Plano, Texas. Something on the order of 18 teenagers overdosed and died for various reasons because they had taken narcotics of some form, had an allergic reaction, the pollutants in it or whatever else, and all of them had people, contemporaries that were around them, and in every case, the people waited until it was too late and they died. A friend of mine, his name is Mike Gray. He's not a relation to me. He's written a book also. It's called Drug Crazy. It's a good book. It's not as good as mine, but it's a very good book. Because he was so concerned, he went to Plano, Texas, talked with the powers that be down there, including the chief of police and those sorts of elected officials, and said, look, can you see what's going on here? Can you see that it is our laws that are resulting in the deaths of our children? Why don't we change an ordinance to allow people to take others in medical distress, including themselves, to get medical help without any repercussions? No questions will be asked and no repercussions. And you know what the city fathers there said? No! Why? It's that same tired and totally false last chance reason that everybody always gives. If we were to do that, we would be sending the wrong message to our children. That is fundamentally the only rationale that people use to justify this terrible failed system that we have. But let me ask you this question. What's the right question? Because the question, the answer that we're giving to our children now is, if you use drugs, go ahead and die. Your life is not worth saving. And I swear to you that that is not the message that we believe or the message that we want to give to our children. So we are fighting several things here that are transparently unable to be fought. We cannot repeal the law of supply and demand. I wish people in Washington had taken accounting 1A. If you would understand the law of supply and demand, you would realize that it cannot be repealed. I wish that people would simply be able to legitimize this discussion. And we need to tell them. We need to get involved in research. Shreveport, Louisiana had a marvelous program, kind of like a drug maintenance program that is going on in Switzerland. This has marvelous promise. In fact, it's actually being used now very successfully. This comment that he increased drug usage by 100% is flat out wrong, flat out untrue. It has done the reverse. It reduces crime. It reduces drug abuse. It increases the health of people. It increases their ability to support themselves, to pay their taxes, takes them off the dole, and increases drug treatment. So we need to come back with research. And fundamentally, I like to ask questions. It's what I do. Try to get answers occasionally. But ask you this, because I know the answer for me. It makes as much sense to me to put this gifted actor, Robert Downey Jr., in jail for his drug abuse, as it would have Betty Ford in jail for her alcohol abuse. Is there any difference? And the answer has to be no. I used to say that about Daryl Strawberry. You all remember him, very gifted baseball player, truly has a cocaine problem from what I understand. However, he was arrested and convicted and sent to jail not long ago for driving a motor vehicle under the influence of cocaine. And you know what I say to that? Good. Precisely what should happen. The criminal justice system is very much geared up to address people's actions. And if anyone's actions, by taking drugs and then their actions put us at risk, put us at jeopardy, bring them to me. And that is exactly where the criminal justice system should respond, and will, and very effectively. Drug courts, a marvelous program. You don't understand. And I've been doing this for 18 years. Drug courts are a positive revolution in the criminal justice field. Judges like me, prosecutors, probation officers, treating people as human beings, as individuals instead of numbers. Instead of being a fill-in-the-blank, junkie, dirtbag, whatever, they're now human beings with failings, with desires, with needs, with wants. And yes, they relapse. And we realize that, and we have a sanction. It's really the parents' patriae. You know, I am the father who can either spank or commend. And it works. It takes a lot of effort, though. It takes a lot of resources. But where we go wrong, where drug courts are a trap, and I mean that deeply, drug courts can and hopefully will not be used to perpetuate the same failed system. We should not, we must not bring people into the criminal justice system because of what they put into their bodies. Flat out mistake. What you do instead is hold people accountable for what they do. And if they come into the criminal justice system because of their actions, like 95% of all spousal abuse cases are alcohol related, things like that, driving under the influence, and if they happen to have that substance abuse problem, put them in drug court and we'll deal with them there. Ronald Reagan, of all people, said it best. It is the function of government to protect us from each other. And I agree with him completely. But he went on to say that where government goes astray is where government tries to protect us from ourselves. And he's absolutely right. And that is the failing of the war on drugs. It is so artificial. It is destined for failure. It failed before. It is failing now. It is continuing to fail. And Ronald Reagan, unfortunately, failed to follow his own advice. But he was right. So we need to talk to people about these issues. And we need to tell them, again, don't be afraid. It's okay. It's the compassionate thing to do. There are other things to discuss as well. Economics, you know, people naturally resist change. I understand that. That's perfectly logical. But we also have a perpetuation of the status quo that cannot be minimized. We have a government bureaucracy that has built up to continue to perpetuate the war on drugs that is colossal. In fact, as I refer to it, we have a runaway freight train of federal money in favor of the status quo. I ran for Congress, 1998. I was younger then, but talked to two sitting congressmen in Orange County, pretty conservative area, trying to get them to support my campaign against Bob Dornan, who you may have heard of, and I have the scars to prove it. But I talked to them to try to get them to support me, and they brought it up on their own. Of course, they were aware of my position with regard to drug policy. And they told me, said, Jim, of course you're right. We in Washington really know that the war on drugs isn't working. But the problem is worse than you think. Because every federal agency we have gets extra money to fight the war on drugs. It is earmarked expressly in all of these budgets, this extra money, and they are addicted to the money. And it's not just the big guys, the obvious ones, like the military and the DEA and the Department of Customs, Bureau of Customs, Department of State, all the rest of that sort of stuff. It's the little guys, too. It's the Bureau of Land Management. It's the Department of Agriculture, the Bureau of Indian Affairs. All of these organizations as well get extra money earmarked to fight the war on drugs. And do you think they want to give it up? And of course, the answer is no. So they take extreme positions. We take extreme positions because it's our government and it's up to us to call a halt to it. They will not do it. What are some of these extreme positions? One of them truly is medical marijuana. Okay. One of them is medical marijuana, where they are beating up on sick people. Another one is hemp. You should all be aware of hemp. Hemp is marijuana stock. It has no psychotropic properties whatsoever. but has been used traditionally for thousands of years as a viable commercial product. And the hemp seeds as well. They can be manipulated so that they have no form of psychotropic properties whatsoever. And there are all of these products that have been used traditionally over time that are very, very constructive and helpful in society. In fact, back in the ancient Greek word, the word cannabis and canvas were one of the same thing. So we, of course, have outlawed this entire industry, except during the Second World War. You ought to see Hemp for Victory sometime, actually a show produced by the Department of Agriculture talking about the beneficial usages of this for tow ropes, etc. But time is fleeting. But I can tell you that now our federal government is taking another extreme, in fact, downright silly position. So we are trying to keep out from our country the imports of hemp products from other countries, such as Canada and England, you know, those liberal, wild-eyed countries. So, products such as clothes, 2x4s, lacquer. I use hemp shampoo, used it this morning. It's widely commercially available. They would talk literally about keeping this out of our country. What, to protect us? Do they think I'm going to get high from snorting shampoo? It is unbelievable what we are doing. It is downright silly. But this is the policy of the government of the United States of America. So we need to tell our people, don't be afraid. It's okay. It is the economically prudent thing to do. We do have hope. We do have hope. Look what's going on in Switzerland. Look what's going on in Holland. These will be on our programs tomorrow. We must deprofitize these drugs somehow. We must medicalize them so that we utilize the medical community more in addressing these very serious needs. And, of course, use the criminal justice system to hold people accountable for their actions. We can do that. So finally, because it's up to us, it is our government, and we are the ones who must call a halt to this. And I'm reminded that there was a story one time where a man was on the earth and saw all of these problems with all of the poverty and all of the suffering and finally died, went to heaven, and had an occasion to speak with God. And he looked at God and he actually raised his fist to God and said, "How can you, with all of the poverty and all of the suffering and disease and killing, why don't you do something?" And God shook his head and looked back at him and said, "I did do something. I sent you." It's up to us. If we want to do something significant for our country, and I know we all do, we cannot do anything more important than repeal drug prohibition and stop visiting these problems upon ourselves. When we finally repealed alcohol prohibition, you may not be aware of this, crime went down countrywide after 1 year by 65%. And continued to go down each year thereafter until the beginning of the Second World War. So these are the most critical issues facing our times. Our policy of drug prohibition, with all of the killing and destruction and harm that it is visiting upon ourselves. We do have hope. We do have options. And to those who agree that it is, in fact, long since time to move beyond the war on drugs, I leave you with the thought, don't be afraid. It's okay. It's the right thing to do. Thank you all.
The indictment against Billy Wafer was dismissed because his lawyer was able to present witnesses and time cards that confirmed that Mr. Wafer was at work the time the deal was alleged to have happened. Mr. Wafer's lawyers have filed a suit against Tom Coleman and Sheriff Stort, alleging that they conspired to eliminate blacks from Tulia by manufacturing evidence in the drug sting.
I'm happy. To an extent, I'm not elite about it. Our goal was to get those that was in prison out, and yet I proved my innocence. They're still sitting in prison, so I'm not going to really be completely fulfilled until we complete the mission. The mission is to get those that's in prison out, and you know, for them to prove they're innocent too. And once we do that, I'll be very happy.
Thank you. I'm Suzanne Wills. I'm an activist in Dallas, Texas. One thing we try to do is get our speakers before audiences. I'm the Speakers Bureau Coordinator, and I have no luck whatsoever getting any speaker before a black audience. And if you could offer me any suggestions for what I might do to reach the black community. I'd be very grateful.
Excuse me. I'd like to field that question. The issue of black participation in the drug policy reform movement is probably as old as the movement itself. And the way it's often phrased to me is that how can we get black people to participate in this movement? But this movement, since I've been involved, is essentially an education movement designed to make people aware of the damages to society that are the result of our drug policy. And the key is that it's an education movement. There hasn't been a lot of activism. So one has to ask themselves, in what way would the black community be educated in participating in seminars such as this? Now, I think it's been, 7 or 8 years since Gary Webb at the San Jose Mercury News printed his controversial expose of CIA and cocaine. Now, I lived in Oakland in the 80s at the height of this so-called cocaine epidemic, which it was. It was a little rough, a little more gunfire than usual, and some pretty harsh realities on the street, more prostitution, more unsavory street activities, so to speak. But even around 1985, I think that you could ask any 15-year-old white, black, yellow, brown crack dealer on the corner, where's the coke coming from? And they could tell you, it's the government, the CIA, the spooks, whatever. It's like no big deal. It's like, and I believe if you trace the origins of Gary Webb's story, it was some black folks in Oakland. Some black folks in Oakland that talked to Gary Webb. You know? Like all the other black folks in Oakland knew what was going on. And when Gary Webb published that story, you can imagine what erupted in Oakland. From Richmond to San Jose, all of the black people rose up and said, duh, who's this Gary Webb guy? Doesn't he know he's not supposed to talk about that? Well, apparently the 15-year-old kids in Oakland were more aware of the reaction of the people at the New York Times and so forth than was Gary Webb. And Gary Webb knew more about what was going on in the drug trafficking world of the United States than did the drug policy movement. So once again, one has to ask themselves, in a movement designed to educate people as to the intricacies, the details, the realities of the drug war, what is it that black people would have to learn from an education seminar of white people designed to tell other white people what's going on in the drug war? Like, what's in it for them? What is going to keep them awake? When you stand before a microphone and say, the drug war disproportionately punishes black people in the United States. They know that. So when you ask, do more black people not show up at these demonstrations opposed to drug war activities in the United States? Perhaps it's because at demonstrations, what happens if they go wrong, the police show up. They don't beat up the white guys in the suits. They wade in and they beat the black people up. They pick the black people out and they take them to jail. Because they can get away with it. You don't go beating on a white guy in a suit in the head with a billy club because you get your ass suit off. And it doesn't matter who you are, cop or not. And that's in all movements. That is in all movements. So when white people say to black people, come and join our movement because you need to stand up for yourself, perhaps from their point of view, it looks like maybe there's a fight between the white people and they need some cannon fodder. So you're asking people to come in and join an educational process so they can hear a whole lot of stuff that they already know and they can stand up to the man and get their ass kicked so that the white people can say, see, they're racists. But the black people already knew that the white people were racists. And these black people being dragged off to these jails, once again, are learning something that they already knew. But wait, what about the argument that, look, 28% of the black adult males enter the criminal justice system in the United States. And half of that is over this drug war. This is a black problem in the United States. This is a black problem. We need black people to participate. But in the 1940s, there was a Jewish problem in Germany. There was a Jewish problem. Was that a Jewish problem? I don't think so. Is this a black problem? This is not a black problem. This is a white problem. This is a problem with white people. And white people have to solve it. And they do not solve it by educating black people as to what flavor of oppression they are suffering. The white people have got to stand up to the white people and stop it. Look around. Look around at what you've seen since 9-1-1, this Patriot Act, and all of the revocation of the Bill of Rights since this drug war started. Who's doing that? Black people? White people are doing that. And who can stop it? Black people? What do we need? Lawyers. What are lawyers? They're usually white. I look around in a meeting like this. I see academics, intellectuals, doctors, some lawyers, some judges, some ex-cops. I see power. This is what I see. I see power here. I see a lot of unused power. I see a lot of power trying to be educators. Why not let the educators educate and use the power for power? So let's talk about white power. Let's talk about white power for a minute. How do you use white power? How do you use white power to get black people to participate? Let's use Houston for an example. Okay, pick a neighborhood. Pick a neighborhood in the Fifth Ward. Pick a nice black neighborhood in the Fifth Ward. Pick a nice black neighborhood in the Fifth Ward that you see getting beaten down. And you can see a neighborhood getting beaten down by looking at the statistics. The arrest, the crime, the evictions. How many people are going to jail? How many dropouts? It's not hard to find a neighborhood that's getting beaten down. Pick a neighborhood, make that your model neighborhood. When you leave this educational seminar, you take that white power. Now, the first thing you need is lawyers. Do not go to the ACLU. Do not go to these institutions that have this huge draw on their services. No, what you do is you find these lawyers that are making a lot of money on this criminal justice system. And you go to those lawyers and you find out where they drink and you find out where they hang out. And you go to them and you say, hi, I'm Dr. Such and Such, or I'm Judge So and So, and we need some help. We want some pro bono help because we want to bring some good lawyers into this neighborhood to stop this oppression. And when he says, no, what's in it for me and how much money is there? Then you say, no, there's no money in it. What we want is pro bono, no strings attached. We want your services to make this a better society. And when they say no, then you say, what's your name? And you say, so you're saying that you, attorney so-and-so, are saying that you are not going to lend your services to make this a better society. And they say no, or screw you, or whatever, and you go to the next lawyer. And you say, you know, attorney so-and-so said that he's not going to offer his services to make this a better society. What do you say? And if he says no, and you get a list of 10 people like that, then you take that list of names, and you take it, and you publish that list. And you circulate that list into these guilds and into the alternative press. And you say, so-and-so have decided that they are too good and they are too busy, and they are not enough money to lend their services to making this a better society. You take that white power and you use it like a hammer. And you use it like a hammer, but instead of hammering black people with it, you hammer white people with it. And pretty soon, you'll find these people will start playing ball with you. And when you get people start playing ball with you, you'll notice that a such and such Esquire attorney is going to try and outdo so-and-so attorney by showing how much more pro bono he could give than the other guy to see who's got the biggest pro bono, because they want to rep and they don't want to look bad, and it's good for their business. And it's nice when you can say, I'm a lawyer, and put justice next to it. That sells. And if they can win cases and look good and talk about justice, that's good for them. Now, what are you going to do with that? Okay, now you got a band of 10 high-priced lawyers trying to prove who's got the biggest pro bono. You run them down the Fifth Ward to your one little beaten-down neighborhood that you have decided to adopt. Every kid that gets busted in that neighborhood, no matter who he is, gets one of these lawyers. So when those kids enter that railway system that they call a courthouse, they're sitting there with a $1,000 an hour white lawyer pleading their case, and we'll see if these cops can keep getting over with this, well, he dropped the bag stuff. That doesn't work when you got a good lawyer. There's a bunch of free white people that prove it. And the only way you keep these black kids out of jail is with white lawyers. Now, what are you going to do with these kids when you got them out of jail? Okay, how about this? Let's apply for some grants. Let's apply for some educational grants. Let's say that, look, we'll get you out of jail, but you gotta make it through this freshman year in college to get off probation. It's cheaper than jail. The money's out there. Are you going to tell me there's nobody in this room that knows how to write a grant, that can't apply for a grant to put a minority kid in school? How hard is that? Come on. Okay, so you take these street dealer kids, instead of sending them to jail, you give them a high-priced white lawyer, you get them out of jail, you send them to college in this one little five-block square area of the Fifth Ward. And what's that going to get you? A reputation. That's what it'll get you, a reputation. That's called activism. That's called doing something. That's called starting a fire, attracting attention. That'll educate people when the results of this unilateral white power action start showing results. That's real educational. People pay attention to that. And you know who's going to pay attention to that? Black people. You do that. You do that. You show these people that you can do more than talk to them or try and bring them into some movement where they just stick their head up and get it blown off instead of yours. Where you could do something for them, where white people are willing to stand up against white people, then I think you'll get some participation from the black community. Because white, black, purple, red, yellow, green, it doesn't matter. Actions talk. So if the point of these gatherings is to educate empowered white people to the evils and the ills of the drug war, that's fine and good. But you cannot expect black people to be interested in that. And maybe what we need to do at these seminars, at these white people seminars, is to teach white people that they are privileged and that they have to use their privilege and that power to end the injustice and the degradation of this society that's done by white people. Because this is a white problem and white people have got to stop it because it brings us all down.
Everything that you need to prevail in this struggle is right here in this room, and it's right here in this town. And all it takes is for you all to be committed, to be clear about what your commitment is, to remain in action, and to stay motivated by love. And I believe that ultimately you will win, because love always wins.
I'm going to stand until I can't stand no more. If I have to stand by myself, and I don't feel like I'll have to stand by myself because there's too many other people you know is involved in this.
You've been listening to a documentary produced by Kurt Schrell on the drug war, featuring the voices of Drug Enforcement Agency Chief Asa Hutchinson, drug war abolitionist Judge Gray, and the voices of activists and victims. This is Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. Earlier this month, a series of demonstrations and public events were held across the state as part of the New York Interfaith Prison Pilgrimage. Organizers hoped to raise awareness concerning prisons and the criminal justice system by walking to 25 prisons in 22 cities across the state. In conjunction with these activities, a forum was held on April 12th at Ithaca's Southside Community Center, New York State Prisons Inside and Out, an invitation to consider needed reforms.